Hey, welcome to The Look Back, my pandemic podcast, or hopefully post-pandemic podcast, broadcasting here from the basement of Newman Media Studios. My name is Keith Newman, and I'm the host of The Look Back. And this is a place where we have some fun conversations with old friends, a few newsmakers, and some rule breakers, all in the name of sharing insights and experiences along with a little bit of levity and fun. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and if you're so inclined, or perhaps even open to some bribery, you'll share this podcast with some friends who might also enjoy it. Let's go on to the show. Happy Monday in November.
Yeah, I know. It's true.
Gosh, I can't believe it's November already.
I know. The end of the year is upon us. It's insane.
Yeah, and from one of the bios of yours, I read you're supposed to be retired. What happened to that?
Well, I like to meet new people and learn new things. So I read, do a lot of other stuff. But at the end of the day, I stopped thinking about how I spend my time as work a little more than 20 years ago. And because everything I do when I'm not asleep is work. It's work for learning new things, work for giving back, work for making money, maybe not anymore. And, you know, so it's all work. But so I'm not really retired, except when I'm sleeping, then I'm retired.
Right. It's funny. We do sort of fall into these definitions of, you know, what is retirement, which is definitely a scary thought.
Right.
On one hand, and on the other, you find yourself, you know, in new challenges and new opportunities.
Yeah. You know, I'm particularly grateful for the quote unquote computer industry and what it's provided for me. And I'm not all that comfortable with how it's turned out. So the museum has a responsibility as an educational institution to, which we've done with the new mission and purpose, to engage people in a conversation and make them aware that their life doesn't exist without computing, so they need to act wisely and not be tricked.
There's some great topics to explore right there. And it's funny, we kind of jumped right into the conversation on a casual note, jumping into the deeper end now.
Sure.
So welcome to the podcast called The Look Back, but we're going to jump into the present and say, sure, set the table, since you are the head of the Computer History Museum here in beloved Northern California. I think Palo Alto is your specific address. And it's just an amazing building museum, but it's more than a museum. And I think it would be helpful for you to give the listeners a little, and you can do it much better than I can, even sure, though I've been there more than a dozen times myself.
Sure.
You know, in terms of framing out, and I know I've heard about a new mission as well. So if you don't mind, can you kind of help us set the table?
I'm happy to. This is a real opportunity to share with people the mission and purpose of the institution. The history of the Computer History Museum goes back to almost the beginning of time as we know it from computing. Gordon and Gwen Bell, Gordon Bell, one of the really the grandfathers or the godfather of modern computer architecture. He was at Digital Equipment Corporation in the very beginning and built the VAX architecture, for those who are aware of that, and ended up his career at Microsoft in the research organization. And Gordon is still on the board, but he and his wife, Gwen, opened a museum in Boston in the early 1980s. And they had collected an immense inventory of the articles of computing going back in time to early counting machines and things like that. So the core exhibit in the museum does chronicle the first 2000 years of computing. But we all think about computing in the modern era as kind of with the microprocessor and personal computers, at least for most people, clearly there were mainframes for institutional use, and some of the very early, one would argue the ENIAC and others were used, you know, for ballistics and trajectory calculations and things like that. So the current mission and purpose in the museum has evolved beyond collecting and preserving for posterity these artifacts and stories to, as we say now, decoding technology, the computing past, the digital present, and the future impact on humanity to shape a better future. So the digital present is kind of the world that we live in. And I like to say CHM could stand for Computer History Museum, and it does, but it also could stand for computing, humanity, and meaning. And the lens by which we look at everything in the museum is to answer the question of what it means to be human in a world of computing. And so we take that computing, humanity, and meaning statement and turn it around. So the artifacts and inventory, and I'll finish in a second, go back to really, as I said, the beginning of time relative to calculating and counting machines. But we have all the original Fairchild notebooks from the beginning of the microprocessor industry and the integrated circuit. We've got all the Xerox PARC tapes. We've got everything that Digital Equipment Corp ever did. We kind of have one of each kind, at least, of every computing artifact. There are a million plus objects. We have about 2% on display in a 40,000 square foot warehouse that's three bays tall with artifacts in it. We've got a research building with software and paper tapes and business plans and these notebooks and things like that. So it is unparalleled in the world in terms of its collection, and over 1,000 oral histories of the pioneers of the industry, most of which are video and relatively long form, between 4 hours and a week of full chronicled oral histories from the pioneers of the industry.
It's fantastic stuff. So when you call upon a mission now to reset the goal from a museum to how we live in our digital lives, and how do we make sure that we're being good custodians of the technology? I mean, that's a fantastic mission. How do you go about, you know, attacking it?
Well, we're working on a series of things in three or four different areas. First and foremost, we did the repositioning and the restatement of the mission and purpose. The second thing we started focusing on about 3 years ago, which is when we completed the mission work, and it took me about a year. We organized everyone, got all of our feedback and input, and I learned the institution and all the rest. The second and most important thing is to implement technology. If not us, who? Let's just say. So we have a platform under development. It's both an operating philosophy, but also a technical architecture that we call OpenCHM. And what it represents is a modern microservices-based, cloud-based way to manage the collection, to manage all the digital assets, and to make it so our institution can effectively become a programmable institution. We're literally building a developer program that would allow historians and others, obviously, as well as ourselves, to reach into our inventory, because it's so deep and so rich that over time, we want to make it so we can find the important things and then compose them into a digital present conversation. So in other words, if we get our agency from our collection of the computing past, all the artifacts and the stories and the history, and the digital present speaks to drug discovery, environmental concerns, health, education and learning, tutoring, and the use of artificial intelligence or machine learning, AIs that can be helpful for augmenting people's, both their work lives, their learning lives, and the rest, the idea that others would find our artifacts and our stories relevant to their work, we see more and more museums starting to think through those implications. And so there's a small collection of us. We're working with Microsoft, working with Accenture. Paul Doherty, who's the CTO at Accenture, is on our board. We're working with other corporates as well to help us think through, you know, how to unleash these assets in local language, in real time, anywhere in the world.
It is kind of funny. Here you are as this fixed property in Palo Alto, and yet here you in the Computer History Museum, and here you are riding the digital transformation wave, essentially going from on-prem to cloud to create this service that now I don't have to be there to experience all the rich, you know, services and assets you guys have at your disposal.
Yeah, that's right. And let me correct one thing. The physical address is
Wait a sec. I don't have another room for another editor.
No. I believe and I know. We're in Mountain View, right at the corner between Mountain View and Palo Alto. And as most people may or may not know, we're about a mile and a half away from Shockley's building where they invented the integrated circuit. So we're kind of at ground zero.
And by the way, how far from Google's headquarters now?
We are literally the hole in the middle of the donut. They completely surround us. And there's a Microsoft campus right up the road about 200 yards away.
Right.
One of the things that I used to look after. And LinkedIn's around the corner. And, you know, we're...
Yeah, the hole in the donut. I want to leave that as the image. That's fantastic. Hey, this is fantastic. And I know you have tremendous amount of steps to fulfilling on this mission, but I love the direction it's going. How can people support and kind of stay in touch with this this transformation?
Well, clearly, you know, the museum, it's a nonprofit, it's a membership-oriented institution. So our membership start at $15 a year. People can become a digital member and be involved. The programming, most of which is broadcast or streamed, I should say, is available. There's a YouTube channel associated with that. And we do stream things on Facebook as well.
Tons so of content
the programs are accessible. And, you know, obviously, membership matters a lot to us at scale. And so we've encouraged people to consider that for sure.
Okay, well, I hope you have a big membership drive with this new mantra coming up in 23, because I mean, for anybody that's ever walked through this museum, and if you haven't, it's amazing. It's just amazing. And I imagine what you could do on a digital level, you know, will far surpass that.
Yeah. And now we're working really aggressively. OpenCHM includes, you know, our oral history collection, all of our other artifacts over time as we digitize them, we're working on that. And then also, obviously, the building itself, we're working on a digital twin of the building as well.
So. Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting, too. So before I pivot and go into some history with you at the History Museum, but also your history, is also to talk about what would the experience for somebody who, what are you looking to accomplish with for people to look at the past to help them inform them, or is this more current curricula that you're developing? How do you balance that out?
Well, it varies by audience type, and because computing affects everyone, the imagery that I like to communicate is that, you know, you've been in the building a number of times, as you said, and we do rent the facility, which is how most museums also generate revenues. And so we got a lot of partner organizations, that are in the facility all the time, which really, really matters. But I think the most important thing, for us is the programming for, if you will, the younger audiences. We're working on partnerships with Microsoft and Minecraft. There's a Minecraft education edition that brings, there's more than 250,000 kids in less than 6 months that have been involved. We have a Roblox environment. We're working with Roblox. In the first month of Roblox, we're in second month right now, about 1.5, 1.7 million kids have experienced an interactive learning and programming style environment. So we're reaching young audience.
That's great.
We have programs that reach, other audiences, including entrepreneurs. We've got an initiative that we call IDEA, which is for inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, sponsored by the KPOR Center. There's a lot of work going on there to unleash and encourage those that haven't had as much access. So we've got programs in that area as well. So it varies. We're considering this notion that the building itself is like the tree trunk on a really sturdy oak tree. And the collection is like the root system, which is very broad that you don't see most of. But the branches, the technology to reach people where they are, we're grafting on branches by audience to basically test various new programs and ways to reach people all around the world. And as most people know, with off-the-shelf technology, we can have our programs translated in real time into local language and things like that. So again, the idea is to make it so that whether people are physically in the building or not, they can experience what the museum has to offer.
That's brilliant. I love it. I can't wait to dive back in now.
Daniel,
talk to me. This is called The Look Back, and it's so appropriate to be talking to the head of a museum, the Computer History Museum, with the podcast. The other interesting thing is you've had an enlightened career as well, working with Microsoft and Apple, Next and Sony, and working for, I mean, the legends of industry, right? Between Jobs and Gates and Ballmer and Wozniak, yep. Bill Campbell, just a whole number of other famous people who I think are legends. You know, I look at them all as legends, and I don't necessarily even differentiate because they've all made just such spectacular contributions, right?
I would agree.
And unique characters amongst themselves.
Yeah, too. Right.
I mean, they don't fit quietly in the background, right?
No, they don't.
When you look back on this experience of yours, how do you sort of put certain things in place, like in terms of memorializing some of those relationships or looking back on those moments where they were both enlightening, learning, or just kind of interesting business lessons, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I moved to Silicon Valley in the mid late part of 1976. And then in the spring of 77, early spring, I met Steve Jobs and Wozniak when they moved out of the garage and rented the 600 square feet next to the office that I was running for Sony, pretty much fresh out of college. And so we were in fact, I just turned 23, I think. And so, you know, a few years later, I was working at Apple and I got to be part of the team that built the original Macintosh. I did all the outreach work for the Lisa system that was a precursor to the Mac. So I met all the Fortune 500 CEO types in that period. So I was really very fortunate as a result of meeting Steve and his invitation for me to join Apple. You know, to meet a lot of interesting people. And, you know, I think life and things just cascaded from there, which I'll be happy to talk about. But, you know, life is a little bit about what you're presented with and then what you do with it. And maybe, you know, 10% what you're presented with and 90% what you do with it. So I learned.
I like that. I agree, too.
I learned early on, you know, lessons learned in my upbringing with my father in particular. And then my mother was all about reading, but my father was more meeting people. And so those are the two things that have stuck with me. And, you know, serendipity, right place, right time, and then taking advantage of it in a constructive way. My interest was in learning and the implications of using computers for human potential, which goes back to the beginning of the Doug Engelbart, mother of all demonstrations, for the audience. If you haven't read about it, go look it up on your favorite search engine and listen to the beginning of the world as we know it. So, you know, after Apple, Steve, you know, was fired by Apple and asked me to join him as a co-founder at Next, which is Apple's current operating system, is Next Step, which is what we built, and I ran marketing and sales there, so all the product marketing and the rest. And when I left Next, I went to a Kleiner Perkins Bass startup that was a was a big failure, a noted failure. In the end there, Bill Campbell was the CEO. You said I got to work for Bill. I'd worked with him at Apple before that, so that was good. I got fired from that one, but that's okay. We remained good good friends.
Is that Go?
Yeah, Go. That was a big crater.
And then I did some... My journalism background, you're testing.
Yeah, yeah. And then did some consulting work for Apple and IBM's boards. I'd been friends with both. They were doing joint ventures and helped them. So that they trusted me on both sides. So part of that was, you know, doing what you say you're going to do and honoring your word. And so that worked out. And then I did a couple of startups. And then my last 17 years at Microsoft, where I got to work on some really interesting things. For Steve Ballmer. And then in the end, when Satya, who's the CEO, was my last division boss, we were divisionalized into seven divisions. And then when Satya became the CEO, I went to work for Brad Smith, who's the president and vice chair. So Brad was great. I worked on a series of public-private partnerships, campaign technology, environmental sustainability, campaign technology for the 2016 election. So there's stories I could tell you there that would.
I know, we want them. We want them.
And the environmental sustainability agenda and some other work with the academic community and civic tech infrastructure and things like that. So public-private partnerships, basically, for Microsoft at scale. It's an amazing company. And then when I retired from Microsoft, the museum trustees approached me.
It's almost like you trained your whole life in a way for that.
Yeah, well, I love the, you know, the whole, the premise of computing for amplifying human potential, you know, the whole notion that will give, you know, Steve Jobs credit for this notion of wheels for the mind, which was a take on an article or an ad that was in Scientific American that he read, and you thought about the computer as a bicycle for the mind, giving, you know, humans potential to locomote and move with efficiency beyond that of a condor, which I think was the most efficient. But actually, I got to manifest that idea in the program outreach that I did to the university community with the Macintoshes. So that whole Wheels for the Mind poster that you can find on the web of the kid on a bicycle with the Mac on the back of the bike with a tail of the Macintosh being the cord and the mouse, because back then there were cords on the mice, remember? anyway, so I got to manifest that in the market and do all the marketing for that stuff, which was a lot of fun.
What a great road. What about favorite lessons that you take with you or share with others, especially fellow entrepreneurs or people doing the whole startup journey? It was not easy back in the early days, and you got to experience a combination of success and defeat, which is
certainly
amazing to be able to experience both.
Yeah, you know, it's, you have to suspend disbelief for sure. But at the same time, the biggest lesson for me was, I think that marketing is everything, regardless of your role. And by that, I mean education. I think, in a word, marketing is about education. And, you know, the thing that I think sticks with me through those various adventures and journeys was to constantly have an open mind to learn new things. And these days, more and more people talk about it as a growth mindset from Carol Dweck's book, the Stanford professor. But I think the most important thing, at least from my standpoint, is to be really clear about what you know and what you don't know and what you can learn from others. And, you know, to have that curious mind to learn from the market, because for the most part, while they might not be explicit, you know, this is always attributed to Steve Jobs, or I think more importantly to Alan Kay, who said most of the things that were then repeated by others. You know, it's, you know, perspective is worth 90 IQ points, right? So vantage point, seeing things from a different perspective is really the key. And when you accumulate enough experiences that's when you can step outside of yourself or a company and look at yourself as others see you. And you've got to be able to envision what you want to be, but you also have to appreciate where you are at all times. And that's a lesson that I think is really, really important. At least from my experience, it's about the positioning of where you are relative to where you want to be. And then how you get there, invite others, learn from them. And whether it's your customers, your market, your peers, what have you. Because I walked into Silicon Valley, just like I did, you know, going off to school, and just met these incredibly bright people. And learning from them was just astounding. Taking the Macintosh out into the university community and these genius professors and academics who invented most of these things were the ones, we weren't selling them anything. They were buying it.
Yeah.
Because we built something that they had wanted for so long. And so I just learned from those exchanges to be really clear about what I know and what I don't know.
Can you share a fun story, Daniel, from back in the day with whichever company where you were zooming, you were going fast, and then they came that moment where you had to make a decision? And then what were the elements that helped you inform your decision? And whether you made the right one or the wrong one, it's sort of helpful as we learn. We live in crazy, chaotic times, and decision points come up fast. We're driving our hybrid cars in the clouds right now. So does anything ring a bell for you that you think back in some key pivot points in your career?
Well, there are many, many little milestones that add up. I suppose when I was at Apple, we were in the process of reorganizing and doing a first major layoff of in the company's history. John Sculley was the CEO. Steve had been fired and was kind of banished from an operating role. And we were reorganizing the company around three markets and then four service lines, if you will. Creative services and market research and, market intelligence kind of stuff. And the three markets were education, business, and consumer. And I had the education business, and that was 2/3 of the company's revenue. The company was about $1 billion in revenue. So here I am, sort of late 20s, whatever it is. And there were 50 some people in the corporate education domain when I was presented with this, okay, go figure out what you would do to reduce the headcount. And I had a week to do it. And I came in on a Saturday morning and I presented first of the three markets. Everything else was a service operation. And I had taken the 50 some down to 23. I remember the number, and I thought I was being ruthlessly a hatchet person. And John Sculley said, "No, you don't understand. It's you plus 9. You get 10." And I went, I didn't even know where we could find the bodies then, because I was reducing it to one person per program kind of thing. I wouldn't even know how to organize things with 10. So I said, okay, if that's the answer, then that's pretty straightforward. I knew more or less that the 10 roles that I would keep, and then people interviewed and opted into those jobs. Not too long after that moment and that process, which a week later caused us to lay off 25% or 27% of the company, Steve Jobs called me and said he was going to go start a company and he wanted me to come with him. So I went to his place and we went for a long walk, which was Steve's way. I quickly concluded, within 3 days, I talked to him that I would feel awful if I didn't go and they were wildly successful. And I would feel worse if I didn't go and they failed, wondering with curiosity if my presence would have made a difference and they would have been successful. And so I just said I had no other choice but to leave this wonderful role that I had in this amazing company called Apple. And clearly that was a pivotal decision for me. And, you know, the next 5+ years of my life was being a founder at Next and helping the company build what is today Apple's operating system, or runs in your iPhone and your iPad and on your Mac. And so the people I met and the accumulated experiences over those years were pivotal, again, for accumulating relationships and experiences and lessons learned and things like that. So that was a key pivotal moment for sure for me. You're on mute.
Yeah, I was having some background noise. Sorry about that.
Okay, I get it.
What a great story, though. I appreciate that insight. Amazing set of experiences would be not only the size of the companies, the type of the executives, and the unique challenges you face as a young executive. And, I hope you get to use a lot of that experience and knowledge you've gained to take this Computer History Museum up to the next level. It sounds perfectly fit.
Well, it's an ideal place for me in terms of, I do believe that, tools, anything that can be used at scale, like computers, can be used for good or bad. And in effect, we're seeing it every day today. And I think it's important for people to appreciate the potential that computing can bring to life. But I also think that all actors in the sector of humanity need to act and do their job. And so I'm going to argue very strongly in favor of the regulators participating in the equation going forward. As a society, we do not treat everyone equally. There are people with quote unquote disabilities. There are children who are underage, quote unquote, based upon regulation. There are seniors, there are rules of the road when one drives. All of those things create for, civil society and a set of norms in the fundamental definition of the notion of a republic, right? As opposed to not Republican and Democrat, but a republic, a representative body for human beings to thrive. And I think that we've erred on the side of a level of market individualism, where individuals are being targeted and believing that they're getting something for free, and they're not. And I think that, everyone should appreciate that their actions every day have an effect. And so the museum, I think, is at least for me, a place where we can think about that and bring people to the table. We'll do this with partnerships. The museum will not be the place where the digital present experts reside. The digital present experts are out in the market. We will bring them to the table at the museum. We will do that with the agency of having the computing past, where we can tee up the historical lessons. Because history, we all live in real time in history. Everything we see is already old, right? Through your eyeballs. And so history is not about the past. It's about the present having a conversation with the past. And so the digital present, we're very excited about the fact that it's not going away, but we need to be wise about how we reflect on how computing has created the digital present.
Yeah, I'm excited about that voice and that perspective in discussion, whether it's around regulation, security, privacy, social exactly. media networks and how they behave, because there is far too little regulation. I think that's a given. Business is operating in a capitalist society. They are figuring out ways. Hence, the hottest industry in the world is security. It never goes down. The spending in IT security just goes up and up, right? But there has to be more decorum and I think following guidelines. Glad to have your voice, Daniel. That's exciting. You might have to change the name of a division of the History Museum to get deeper into that battle, though.
Yeah, we're. I mean, you know, naming's always a hard problem. And there's a fair amount of brand equity in CHM, which we like. And again, I like the phrase computing humanity and meaning.
I do too. Go leverage that. Marketing is everything.
Yeah. And that's, my hat's off to Regis McKenna on that one. There's a beautiful paper that he wrote called Marketing is Everything. It was published in Harvard Business School Press. It's a 20-30 page paper that 1991 or so that is, wow. You could read it today and it'd knock your socks off.
Hey, Regis has been on my pod. I'm so glad you were able to join me today. Thanks so much. It was great.
Thanks, hearing. Keith.
We could have so much more conversation, but I'm glad we got to tee up some of the new things going on at the History Museum, as well as a look back at some of the cool things you went through.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. All right.
Take care.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Look Back. We do appreciate your support. Welcome any feedback, and would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast and even consider sharing it with some of your friends. For more information and other cool info, check us out at newmanmediastudios.com.